It's the Bert Cohen Show. History is making it happen now. Learning from history, yeah, it can happen every now and then. And making sure that we pick up on the important lessons and try not to repeat them again. Well, you may or may not have heard of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War of 1936 through 39. What does this have to do with you? Well, quite a bit in many ways. It's about justice and political legitimacy. It's about trying to make the world a better place in many different ways. And on April 27, 2014, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade's Archives presents its fourth annual Alba Puffin Award for Human Rights Activism to Brian Stevenson. And our guest right now to talk about what the award is about is Anthony Geist, also known as Tony Geist, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington and an executive committee member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Board of Governors. He's published a photo essay on Seattle area Lincoln Brigade veterans, co-authored with Spanish photojournalist Jose Moreno, Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and its Legacy of Hope. He also curated a traveling exhibit of children's drawings from the Spanish Civil War, which toured the country for 2 years. The accompanying book, They Still Draw Pictures, Children's Art in Wartime from the Spanish Civil War to Kosovo, was published in 2002. Well, Tony, thanks for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show. Tell us, if you would, about, first of all, what the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was and how it lives on in history, and what the archives is about, and perhaps a little bit about why Brian Stevenson was chosen and how it fits with the mission of the Lincoln Brigade.
Yes, thanks, Bert. Thanks very much. It's a real honor to be speaking with you, and particularly to talk about Brian Stevenson and his receiving this year the fourth annual Puffin Alba Award for in defense of human rights. A few words about the Lincoln Brigade. To begin with, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was a group of 2,800 young American volunteers, men and women, broadly representative of all the spectrum of American society at the time, who volunteered, joined the International Brigades in defense of the democratically elected Spanish government that came under assault by General Francisco Franco, who was quickly aided by Hitler and Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
So the Spanish Civil War is often regarded as a dress rehearsal for World War II or the first act of World War II. In fact, it is the first time that the people and a legitimate government took up arms to defend itself against the assault by fascism. With the intervention of Germany and Italy, shortly after the outbreak of the war, it became clear that it was an international war more than a civil war. And soon 40,000 volunteers from over 50 countries around the world volunteered to fight in defense of the Spanish Republic. And as I said, there were about 2,800 Americans who joined that struggle, known as the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Right. And as I say, that was a long time ago, and Tony, you and I got to know many of the vets, and it was an amazing honor to know these incredibly dedicated men and women, just real American heroes who put themselves on the line, many of whom did die in Spain. Now they're gone. You know, I don't think there's any of them left alive, maybe one or two, I'm not sure. But
perhaps one or two left alive, we're not sure.
Yeah. Now, this award that's going on, the Alba Puffin Award, what is the purpose of this award that was awarded to Bryan Stevenson? How is this in context with the mission of the men and women who fought for freedom and democracy in Spain?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question, and the answer is not evident on first glance. But in fact, what the award is designed to recognize those people and organizations who in the 21st century are carrying forward what we believe to be the spirit of the Lincoln Brigade. The Lincoln Brigade actually took up arms in an armed conflict against fascism. While I feel that, and we feel that our struggles today are quite different, the spirit of the Lincoln Brigade continues on. And we have identified it, basically we, meaning Alba, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, and the board, have identified the form that this mission and struggle takes in the new century, nearly a century later, 80 years later, after the Spanish Civil War, in defense of human rights. So the award was created 4 years ago in collaboration with Puffin Foundation. The first award was given to the Spanish magistrate, Baltasar Garzón, who indicted Pinochet. And since then has been given to Freddie in 2012, Freddie Passarelli and Kate Doyle for their work in Central America, to United We Dream last year, 2013, a group of youth-led immigrant activists, and this year to Bryan Stevenson. And I feel it's particularly appropriate for Bryan Stevenson, given his work, his extraordinary work with the Equal Justice Initiative. The Lincoln Brigade was extraordinary in many senses in American history and American society, but not the least of which was for being the first racially integrated military unit in American history.
Right.
Black and white soldiers served side by side. There were about 80 amongst the 2,800, there were 80 or 85 African-American volunteers in Spain in the Lincoln Brigade. And in fact, the United States Army would not be integrated until toward the very end of World War II.
Right.
So, nearly 10 years later it happened in the American Army. But there was even an instance of a black commander who led white troops in Spain. Oliver Law was the commander of the Lincoln Brigade. He was killed on the attack of Mosquito Hill. So I think it's particularly appropriate to recognize Bryan Stevenson's work for his commitment to economic and racial justice, which in the U.S. today, which I think is a particularly effective reformulation of the mission and the commitment of the brave men and women of the Lincoln Brigade so many years ago.
And it does seem like, at the time in 1936 through 39, I guess the Abraham Lincoln Brigade did get some press, but nowadays, it's frankly not very well known, and I'm not sure if the Equal Justice Initiative is very well known either. But sometimes fights for justice can be somewhat lonely, but after a while there is a victory. Now, of course, the Spanish Republic lost the battle to the fascists and had the brutal dictatorship of Francisco Franco, but eventually Spain did come back to having some sort of democracy and a bit more of a republic. So oftentimes it takes a long time to have some victory. And I wonder, you know, as I say, there might be one or two vets alive out of 2,800 that went there. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, what is it doing now in schools and elsewhere to raise the profile and understanding of what the Lincoln Brigade was and why it's such an important thing in history? What's going on with public education on this?
Okay, that's an excellent question, Bert. Let me refer very briefly back to the earlier part of your statement, your question, about how slow it seems to be moving, how the Lincoln Brigade is not recognized yet. What they did and what they stood for was so incredibly important. And I think the same is true of Bryan Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative. He made a remarkably eloquent statement in his TED Talk in which he says, the arc of justice is long, but ultimately it bends toward justice. I think this is particularly true in the case of both of the Lincoln Brigade and of the Equal Justice Initiative. So what ALBA is currently engaged in now are a number of educational initiatives, workshops, teacher training workshops, principally for high school teachers, in which we make the documents from the archive accessible to high school teachers and show them how effective ways to use them in the classroom, encouraging teachers to do a unit on the Spanish Civil War and on the Lincoln Brigade in their history and social sciences classes, and also in actually in Spanish language and literature and culture classes in school. You know, the Lincoln Brigade has largely been written out of American history, a direct consequence of the Cold War. So this is our attempt to bring it back into the curriculum, to make it known, to have it be an inspiration both for the teachers and the students. What we conceive of in ALBA as our most urgent mission is to make the legacy of the Lincoln Brigade live today and be meaningful today, and that, which is why it's taken the form of human rights, recognition of human rights.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show in the first part with Anthony Geist, professor of Spanish and Comparative Literature at the University of Washington, and he's on the executive committee of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Board of Governors, Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, also known as ALBA, and carrying it on, carrying it forward. And this award that ALBA is presenting to Bryan Stevenson includes a cash prize from the Puffin Foundation. What can you tell us about the Puffin Foundation and their relation to the Lincoln Brigade and the mission of ALBA?
Well, the Puffin Foundation was created by Perry Rosenstein and his family to support progressive arts, artists and artistic projects that have a progressive bent, which very often find difficulty receiving support, financial and otherwise. And we have a long history with the Puffin Foundation. That is, ALBA has a long history with the Puffin Foundation of working together on a number of different projects. We've enjoyed their very generous support for a number of years. And the ALBA Puffin Award in recognition of human rights, which is, I think, probably economically the single most important human rights award in the world today.
Wow.
Which is quite extraordinary. And it came about as a result of long conversations with the Puffin and our history working together. And we're extremely, extremely grateful to them for this.
And I believe it's a cash prize of about $100,000, which is quite significant.
That is correct. It is quite significant, yes.
Yeah. the what was the process by which Bryan Stevenson was chosen? It must be an interesting process to choose. Are there a lot of people who apply for this Alba Puffin Award? And it's all about carrying on human rights, I believe.
We receive nominations for the, there's a subcommittee within Alba and Puffin that fields nominations for award recipients. And the committee goes through them and looks for linkages to the mission and the spirit of the Lincoln Brigade, the legacy of the Lincoln Brigade, in ways that we feel is compelling. And Bryan Stevenson's case is just extraordinarily compelling for all the reasons. His work with incarcerated populations, children in prisons, his struggle for racial and economic justice, we feel just undeniably carries forward the vision and the mission of the Lincoln Brigade.
Well, if people, it's a very exciting history, and the work is being carried on for sure. If people are interested in learning more about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, can you point them to a website?
First place I would refer anyone to is our website, alba-valb.com. There's all kinds of information. There's on there about the Alba Puffin Human Rights Award. But also we have a number of traveling art exhibits available through there. There are curricula plans for teaching Spanish Civil War, enormous resources available online. And then, of course, there are actually our physical archives housed in the Tamiami Library at New York University, which is a treasure trove for people researching radical history in the 20th century, the Lincoln Brigade, links between Spain and the U.S. and so forth.
Yes, it's quite a ongoing project and process. Tony Geis, thanks very much for being with us. We're going to go over to Bryan Stevenson in a minute, but we're going to go out by playing a song called The Abraham Lincoln Brigade, and it's by John McCutcheon. So stay with us. Thanks again, Tony.
Oh, and thank you, Bryan.
All right.
From the farms, from the cities, from every land came the Abe Lincoln Brigade. With a dream in their hearts and a gun in their hands, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Cries from the cities, shouts from the hills, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The fire in the hearts that is warming us still, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. No passeran, no passeran, so sang the Abe Lincoln Brigade. Across the years and the oceans, we still sing the song of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The legend continues. The work goes on. The men and women are largely gone, but they lived long, good lives and real heroic people who put up with some very, very difficult challenges. They were not particularly well known and still aren't, but carrying on very important work. And people in America these days, let's face it, not everybody thinks about prisons and people in prison and their families and what's going on with that. Well, there's, excuse me, a lot going on with prisons and prison reform. There's the privatization scourge that's happening across the land. But we have on the phone with us Brian Stevenson. Are you there, Brian?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, thank you so much. And we were talking just before with Tony Geist of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Executive Committee about the award that is being given out April 27th. And you are the recipient of this award. And just to let listeners know, Brian Stevenson is founder of executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative based in Montgomery, Alabama. He's also professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. Stevenson has won national acclaim for his work challenging bias against the poor and people of color in the criminal justice system. Since graduating from Harvard Law School and the Harvard School of Government, he's assisted in securing relief for dozens of condemned prisoners, advocating for poor people, and developed community-based reform litigation aimed at improving the administration of criminal justice. In 2012, Stevenson represented defendants in the historic Supreme Court consolidated cases Jackson v. Hobbs and Miller v. Alabama, in which the court ruled mandatory life sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional. Hey, every now and then the courts get it right. Well, Brian, again, thanks very much for being with us. You've won a lot of prizes in your career. What makes this one from the Lincoln Brigade Archives unique?
Well, I'm just so honored to be associated with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the Puffin Foundation, which has done such great work to advance social justice in this country. I think that because of the historic work of the brigade, people who are willing to stand when everybody else remained seated, and people who are willing to speak when everybody else was quiet, you definitely take great pride in an award like this. I think so much of human rights work and so much of social justice work in this country is work that requires courage. It requires sometimes overcoming the hopelessness that people have about particular problems and situations and believing things that other people haven't seen. And I think that was true of the brigade, and to be associated with that effort and this fantastic organization for me is a source of tremendous pride.
Well, I've been very pleased to be associated with it myself. And here in New Hampshire presented, we put up a plaque in the State House to the New Hampshire volunteers with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade back in 2001. And the plaque came down under pressure from the right wing. So the struggle still goes on. And the people of New Hampshire being protected from the dangers of the plaque is in a vault right now. Brian Stevenson, what inspired you to create the Equal Justice Initiative? What needed to be done that wasn't being addressed?
Well, I think it was exposure to the problem. I grew up in a poor community where the schools were not integrated when I actually started my education.
Oh, my.
Lawyers came into our community and opened up the public schools and implemented Brown versus Board of Education. Black children could go to the public schools. And that witness, that legacy, was always in the back of my mind. And when I went to law school, I was looking to do work that would advance that legacy, advance that history, and found myself in Georgia with an organization providing legal services to people on death row. And it was sort of shocking to me that we had people in this country literally dying for legal assistance. We have no right to counsel for death row prisoners after their convictions are affirmed on the initial appeal. And I discovered this world of people who were condemned and poor and unable to get the legal assistance they need to prove their innocence or a wrongful conviction or a wrongful sentence. There was no state where this problem was more extreme than the state of Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so in 1989, I decided to try to create some institutional presence here to help the condemned on Alabama's death row. And I really didn't expect to stay. My initial hope was to get this project off the ground and hire a director and then go back to Atlanta. But obviously that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. 25 years later, I'm sitting here and very grateful for the opportunity I've had to represent the incarcerated and the condemned.
And it seems to me, my sense is that the vast majority of Americans, unless they're directly affected, don't even think at all about prisons. You write that in the U.S., there remain serious challenges in the field of human rights that require persistence and increased awareness to confront. The awareness seems to be so limited about this, and people, you know, they just want to sweep it under the rug and just, you know, don't even think about the people in jail. How are you increasing the awareness? I mean, I can see the persistence. How that's a real challenge, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. I mean, the fact that the U.S. now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, we have 5 million of the world's population, but 25% of, well, 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's in prison population. Mm. You know, it speaks to how we've become indifferent to injustice and inequality and abuse in many sectors. The prison population in 1972 was 300,000. Today it's 2.3 million. There's 6 million people on probation and parole. And so I think part of the challenge is just getting people to be more honest about what, you know, the politics of fear and anger have done in American society, that we're putting people in prison sometimes for decades for simple possession of marijuana. I've represented men and women who are serving life without parole sentences for writing bad checks for minor, nonviolent property crimes that don't amount to $100. And we'll spend $60,000 or $70,000 a year to keep these folks in prison for decades, you know, for committing a small crime that, you know, resulted in $50 or $100 worth of loss. And so part of our challenge is educating people about these facts, the work we've been doing with children. The U.S. is the only country in the world that condemns children to die in prison, some as young as 13. We've got 3,000 kids sentenced to die in prison, and that's not known. And so we've got to get information out, and that's part of the work we're trying to do.
And that amazed me, children in adult prisons. I mean, it really sounds absolutely medieval. Maybe I'm insulting the medieval times. Tell it, how many children are there in adult prisons? It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, and it's all happened in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, in the 50s and 60s, we didn't have this problem. We didn't put kids in prison. This has all started in the late 80s and 90s when you had criminologists coming up with these crazy theories about how some children aren't really children, and they termed this term, super predator, to characterize these kids, and all of a sudden, we started sending thousands of children to adult prisons. Today, we have 250,000 people in our adult prisons who are serving time for crimes they committed when they were children. On any given day, we have about 10,000 children in an adult jail or prison who are under the age of 18. And then, as I've mentioned, we've got these 3,000 kids who've been condemned to die in prison, and is given life without parole sentences, some for non-homicide offenses, where some of them were as young as 13 or 14.
Absolutely amazing. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson, winner of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Puffin Award for Human Rights Activism, Children in Jail. And it just brings up so many different questions. You know, oftentimes these prisons are called correctional facilities. And we hear about recidivism. How effective, you know, in general, are these jails? And I want to, of course, move on to issues of class, race, and poverty. But just in general, how effective are these prisons at providing correction? Do they make these offenders better people?
No, I think we've completely abandoned rehabilitation and correction in most of our states. It's just really tragic. You know, again, 30 years ago, you could see people in jails or prisons getting counseling, treatment, education, services. If they were disabled or suffering with mental illness, there might be a diagnosis, right, and there'd be a requirement that they get the medication that they need. Today, we do the opposite. We deny people counseling. We deny people treatment. We deny people education. We warehouse them. The prisons are overcrowded. They're increasingly violent. They're managed by people who are insulated from accountability, which just increases the level of victimization and abuse. In most states, if someone is in prison and sick, they actually have to pay to see a medical doctor. And even though they have no ability to make money, they end up unable to get health care treatment that they need. And it's one of the reasons why we're seeing multi-drug-resistant TB in prisons. We're seeing these highly infectious diseases, which ultimately undermine public safety for everybody because these guards come home with these treatable illnesses that are going untreated because the inmates can't afford medical care. I mean, there's just all of these collateral consequences to the way we have abandoned correction and rehabilitation. You lose your right to vote in several states. In my state of Alabama, about 34% of the black male population has permanently lost the right to vote.
Whoa.
And it's almost as if we're trying to marginalize people, you know, reduce people to their worst crime, to their worst act,
right,
and then abuse them. And so you see that as one of the ways in which we have completely abandoned rehabilitation. And what's sad is that there's new data out there that suggests that we can help people with behavioral problems, with drug problems, with other kinds of problems. If you think of drug addiction and drug abuse as a healthcare problem,
of course,
there are interventions that are very effective. But instead, we treat it as a crime problem, and we lock people up, and we abuse them, and then we put them back out on the street. And it's the reason why one in three people going to prison is returning to prison after failing after release.
Now, it's the life that they've known and haven't had other opportunities here. You say that it's gotten worse in the past 30 or so years. What is there a particular turning point that
yes.
changed things? What might that be?
Yeah, I think first it started actually during the Nixon era when, in response to the activism of the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, you know, President Nixon latched onto a narrative that says we're going to get tough and
right.
basically theorized that all of this activism wasn't a response to legitimate political problems or bad government, but was a function of kids on drugs. And so we have to declare a war on drugs, and this very misguided war on drugs that really kicked in the 80s is the primary reason why the prison population has grown so dramatically. About half the people in prison are there for simple possession of drugs, marijuana, and other low-level narcotics. And so that's a very big part of the story. And then the second part really has to do with just our love of punishment, the political culture that emerged in the 80s and 90s, where politicians were competing with each other to see who could be toughest on crime. And that's what got us mandatory sentences and three strikes, you're out.
Right.
And it's how you end up in a system where you have people who steal pizzas getting sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. Parole. Now, economically, it's quite irresponsible because it costs a fortune. We spent $6 billion on jails and prisons in 1980. Now we're spending $80 billion. And these billions of dollars are coming from our education budget, from our public roads and public services budgets, from care for the elderly, care for the disabled. And it's one of the reasons why so many states are in economic crisis today.
Wow. And oftentimes, if you listen to this show regularly, you know I regularly bash Republicans, but the whole three strikes, you're out, looking tough on crime, Democrats were just about as guilty. Tip O'Neill was part of the problem back then.
You're so right, Bert. I mean, you know, 1996 was one of the worst years in our history when
really?
It comes to criminal justice policy because President Clinton signed the Welfare Reform Act, which actually allowed states to ban people with drug convictions from public housing, from food stamps, from certain kinds of medical benefits. It was in 1996 with a Democrat in the White House and a Democratic Congress, that Democratic Senate, that we allowed a new class of person to be created, our untouchables. That was during Democratic leadership. The Prison Litigation Reform Act in 96 banned prisoners from complaining about conditions of confinement. It's insulated really horrific practices from effective litigation. And finally, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act restricted habeas corpus, which was considered essential in a democratic society to protect against wrongful conviction and abuse of power. The Congress passed this horrific law that has shielded these convictions, including many innocent people who've been wrongly convicted but can't get in front of a court because of these restrictions that are buried in this Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. And so you're right. I think the problem has become completely a problem of the American political process. Both parties are responsible for the kind of high levels of incarceration that we see. And I think both parties have an obligation to respond to these difficulties and begin thinking about solutions.
Well, it must be so easy just to sweep it under rug. When did that law come in, anti-terrorist thing that took away habeas corpus? When did that happen?
That was in 1996 as well. It was in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it had nothing really to do with the bombing. Habeas corpus is, you know, historic, and it's been a vital feature of how incarcerated people challenge wrongful convictions. And what the Congress basically did was create a statute of limitations. They said if you can't file your appeal within a year, you are permanently barred. And what that meant, of course, is that most people who can't hire lawyers couldn't get their appeals filed, and then they're stuck forever. They had other features that have made it increasingly difficult for cases to be reviewed.
Wow. It's, of course, worse than I thought. Well, it's been kept from our vision. Is there an issue of class, in terms of consciousness about prisons, is there an issue of class, race, and poverty with regard to consciousness about prisons? In other words, are more people in the lower economic strata affected by problems in our correctional system than other classes? I mean, I would think the families, I mean, people who, you know, throw these guys in jail and you know, lock them up, throw away the key, they don't think about it. So, you know, it seems to me in the better off economic strata, they don't think about it at all. What about in the lower economic strata and different areas of race?
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any question that there are huge aspects of mass imprisonment that have been shaped by race and class. The Bureau of Justice reports that 1 in 3 black male babies is expected to go to jail or prison during their lifetime.
Oh my.
1 in 3.
Oh my God.
That was never true in the 20th century. It was never true in the 19th century. It's true in the 21st century. And that's dramatically higher than the rate for other people. The impact of some of these policies, you know, drug possession, for example, is a crime where people of color do not offend in higher levels than majority people.
Right.
So only about 13% of the people illegally in possession of drugs are African American, but about 35% of those people arrested are black, and 55% of those convicted are black, and nearly 75% of those sent to prison are black or brown. And these disparities illustrate the way race and race consciousness shapes our thinking. We apply presumptions of guilt to young men of color, boys of color, black and brown men and boys, many of whom have done nothing wrong, who are very accomplished, who are very motivated and hardworking, are often presumed guilty or dangerous just by walking into a space or being in an area where someone thinks they don't belong. And that presumption then makes them very vulnerable to mistreatment. And whether you're talking about Trayvon Martin or you're talking about somebody who's been accused of a crime and been convicted, it adds to the burden of racial bias to see a criminal justice system exploiting it the way it does. And poverty works the same way. We have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. And because of that, the poor, black and white, are vulnerable. They can't get the legal help they need to defend themselves when they've been wrongly accused. Or if they've done something wrong, they can be overcharged, over-prosecuted, and over-sentenced.
Hmm.
They can't do anything about it because they can't afford the legal help they need to protect themselves. And it really becomes a very dramatic example of the way in which race and class have undermined the aspirations of so many people and contributed to a narrative of historic exclusion and inequality.
I have to say, you're reminding me of a brief video I saw, an experiment that was done. They had this one particular car parked, you know, in a city, and they had a white person trying to, you know, as if he had forgotten his keys and trying to break into the car. And everybody walked by. Nobody did anything about it. But when they had a black person on the same car, police came up right away. And just it's just it was quite an experiment, a very, very, very disturbing.
No, it's a very, very troubling phenomena. I mean, you know, I've been practicing law for 30 years. I feel like I've had some success, but I've been in courtrooms where I'm sitting waiting for a hearing to start, sitting at counsel table where I've had a judge or prosecutor walk out, and the judge will say to me, hey, you go back out there in the hallway. You wait until your lawyer gets here. Don't you come into my courtroom without your lawyer. And I'll have to stand up and say, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the attorney on this case. And then have to laugh with them so they don't get mad with my client when he's come. Comes into court. And that dynamic really reveals the ways in which both conscious and unconscious bias can undermine fair working.
Wow. Amazing. We're talking with Brian Stevenson, Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative, who's winning an award from the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives. Your organization was instrumental in reversing more than 75 death penalty cases. That is seriously impressive. How is this, the death penalty, a human rights issue?
Well, I think, you know, particularly in this country where we have an historical legacy of using violence and lethal force to sustain racial hierarchy and bias against the poor, you know, the death penalty didn't just come out of nowhere. I mean, you know, during slavery, we used the threat of violence and death to maintain kind of racial hierarchy. During the period between Reconstruction and World War II, lynching and the use of violence, lethal violence, was the way we created racial hierarchy and subordination. And the death penalty really became kind of a tool to help reinforce these cultural and social norms. And so for me, the modern death penalty, which is still burdened with all of these disparities, you're 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white than if the victim is black. You're about 22 times more likely to get the death penalty if the defendant is black and the victim is white in many states. My state, you know, about 80% of the people on death row are there for crimes involving white victims, even though 65% of all murder victims in this state are black. We have no people of color in decision-making roles. Mm. There are counties where no person of color has served on a capital trial jury because they're excluded with these discretionary strikes. So there's all of this racial stuff in the American death penalty. There's all of this stuff that indicates bias against the poor. And so the reason why it becomes a human rights issue is that the question of the death penalty isn't, do people deserve to die for the crimes they commit? The question is, do we deserve to kill? And when we've never confronted our history of using violence and lethal violence and lynching and the death penalty to sustain racial hierarchy and domination, we haven't corrected our system so that the poor have the same chance of a fair trial as the wealthy, where we allow race bias and race consciousness to undermine the reliability of verdicts, you cannot engage in executions. You cannot engage in killing and be consistent with human rights. I mean, I don't believe that you should kill people to show that killing is wrong anyway.
Yeah.
But I generally believe in this American context, we have these additional questions. You know, it'd be like in Germany if they started putting people in gas chambers. And if the people who they were putting in gas chambers were disproportionately Jewish, I could not be silent. I could not make peace with that phenomenon. And yet, in this country, we continue to use the death penalty in ways that are very, very racially skewed. We say nothing about our history of abuse in the lynching era or in the slavery era.
Right.
And we're not even connecting how we undermine our commitment to human rights by persisting in the shameful practice of killing people. So I think it's one of the critical issues. It's the crown on the head of mass incarceration, and I think we've got to see it as a basic threat to basic human dignity and human rights.
Human rights, and that's certainly, prison reform certainly made it clear how that's absolutely in the context of human rights, which is one of the things that the Lincoln Brigade is about. Now, some states, these days have binding contracts with private for-profit prison corporations, sometimes guaranteeing 95 to 100% occupancy in facilities leased by private prisons. It seems there's a new burgeoning private punishment industry. The Corrections Corporation of America, not a friend of yours, I'm sure, has spent nearly $14 million on lobbying over the past 8 years. How big of a threat to human rights is this new private for-profit corrections industry?
Well, I think it's an enormous threat. I can't think of anything more perverse in American policy over the last 30 years than the evolution of private prisons. You actually now have people spending millions of dollars to persuade legislators to come up with new crimes, to find new ways to get more people in jail or prison. Having built 2.3 million prison beds, they only make money when those beds are full. And so you have these perverse, just horrific incentives to get people in jails and prisons. And so that's why we now have more children, because we're not able to fill the beds with adults. We have more disabled people, people with mental illness, because people who there are not enough healthy offenders to get. We're now even moving into immigration. We're using private prisons to detain undocumented people and to warehouse them for months and years. And it's just so perverse because until the last 20 years, you didn't have to worry about legislators being paid to create some of these horrific policies. But now you do. It's such a big business. It's such a profitable business that there are millions of dollars now being directed at influencing policies. And it's made reform very challenging because obviously you don't have any money on the other side, on the rehabilitation side, the correction side. There's no moneyed interest. There's no political influence. It's a very difficult dynamic.
My goodness. Again, the Bert Cohen Show, we're talking with Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, who's getting the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives Award. You, Brian, you've developed something called community-based reform litigation aimed at improving the administration of criminal justice. What is this, and tell us how it works?
Sure. Well, we're very interested in working more closely with community groups and in localities where there has been historic disconnect between the people most affected by criminal justice policy and the people most in charge. And so what we've done is developed a set of materials that we provide to community members, educating them about what's going on. Some of these officials that are doing some of this horrific stuff are elected. But because they operate in empty courtrooms or behind closed doors, there's no way of evaluating what they're doing. And so we provide the information that provides more information so that communities can make better decisions about who to support. We have some tools. We have calendars and reports that we're providing to church groups and school groups and community groups so that they can have a deeper, richer, more contextualized perspective on a lot of these issues. And then we do litigation. We will sue on behalf of community members who have been excluded from jury service or who have been excluded from the opportunity to contribute to public safety. And these kinds of efforts we found have been very energizing in the communities where they've taken place, but also incredibly inspiring for us because to see a group of people begin to think that they can make a difference in turning around mass incarceration and changing the narrative that has emerged around the politics of fear and anger, for me, is one of the most exciting things, is to see people becoming hopeful about their ability to make a difference on these issues.
Boy, and that's one of the things that fear depends on, is people on the other side feeling absolutely powerless and just giving up.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that you mentioned, you know, the private for-profit prison industry has tons of money. The Equal Justice Initiative, I'm guessing, has less money. Where do you get your funding? Are there corporations that are helping out?
No, it's a great question. No, we really scrape by. No, we don't have any corporate support. We have some support from private foundations or a handful of foundations that have gotten active in the criminal justice area, but very few, really, in the philanthropy will deal with criminal justice issues. Most of our support just comes from individual donors, from $10 to, $10,000 to a handful of $100,000 donors. But it's mostly individual donors. It's people who have learned about these problems and have been outraged, who have said, I want to contribute in some way to the effort at bringing down the prison population, protecting people from excessive punishment, creating hope in communities where there's an expectation of incarceration. One of my greatest challenges is talking to 13- and 14-year-old kids living in neighborhoods where they tell me they expect to either be dead or in prison by the time they're 21. And that's just heartbreaking and tragic, and fortunately some people have responded to that by supporting our work, and we've been very grateful for that support.
What about the Obama administration and Democrats in power now? What about any kind of impact groups like the Equal Justice Initiative are making in Washington? Are you getting an audience there?
Well, we've started to. In the last 2 years, we've seen a lot more progress than we saw in the first 4 years. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, has actually now implemented some initiatives that I think are going to be very influential on the federal side. You know, the decision to no longer list drug amounts will mean that a lot of people who would have been subject to very lengthy mandatory sentences will now be afforded a more reasonable sentence. They've started shifting some of their funding priorities to also talk about reentry and services for high-risk communities. You know, the president's most recent announcement about My Brother's Keeper initiative, which is targeted at poor and minority youth, may prove very influential, and then some of these initiatives on the school-to-jailhouse pipeline, I think, could be very influential as well. So I'm a little more encouraged than I was a few years ago, and hopeful that, you know, before the president leaves, we can see some significant developments in policy that can create a better environment for reform.
And, of course, this may be too long of an answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Of course, we need to protect the public from dangerous, violent offenders. What might be, can you paint a brief picture of an ideal correctional system?
Sure. Well, I think you absolutely are right. Our top priority has to be public safety, and the goal ought to be to create a system that not only protects the public, but also minimizes the risk of reoffending. And so I think that means we actually have to return to corrections. We have to turn to rehabilitation. We need to embrace restorative justice, where we think about the needs of the community, we think about the needs of the victim, and we think about the needs of the offender, and create plans and solutions that allow all of those needs to be met. You know, for most of our history, our prison population was around 300,000 people in jails and prisons. We need to get back to that, and the prison system needs to be helping us achieve that. In Europe, you see systems that work brilliantly. They have dramatically lower crime rates as a result of their strategies. I think we should have that aspiration here. What we can't do is keep saying, after you've been rape, robbed, and murdered, we're going to get really mad and beat up on the person for you. That's not sensible policy. That's not justice. That's just, you know, taking vengeance, exploiting it, and creating political systems that reward the most angry and most violent and most fearful.
If people, well, congratulations, I must say, on this award, most deserved, that's for sure. And if people are interested in finding out more about the Equal Justice Initiative, is there a website to which you can point them?
Sure, yes. Our website is www.eji.org.
Pretty simple.
Any and all listeners to please visit us there and learn more about our work.
Again, very important work, carrying on the tradition of human rights that the Lincoln Brigade was all about. Congratulations, Brian Stevenson, and thank you so much for being with us and for the work you do. Thank you.
I really appreciate it, Bert. My pleasure.
All right, and this, we're going to go out with a song made by a group of prisoners in 1953. They called themselves The Prisonaires. This is prisoners singing, The Prisonaires Just Walking in the Rain.
Just walking in the rain, getting soaking wet, torture in my heart. my heart. Still remembering people come to windows and they always stare at me, shake their heads in sorrow, saying, who can that fool be? Just walking in the rain, thinking how we met, knowing things have changed. Somehow I can't forget. Change. Somehow I can't fall.